Welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Oncology. This podcast aims to bring you perspectives from leading experts on the significance of the multidisciplinary team for prompt and effective diagnosis and appropriate treatment selection in non-small cell lung cancer, the role of biomarker testing, and how emerging treatment choices are impacting clinical decision making. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an independent educational grant from Merck & Co. Inc., Turning Point Therapeutics, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals Inc., and Sanofi Genzyme. In this podcast, Dr. Alexander Drilon, a medical oncologist, and Professor Keith Kerr, a pathologist, talk about current guidelines for biomarker testing, the advantages and disadvantages of liquid versus tissue biopsy, and how biomarker testing can be used to support treatment decision-making in non-small cell lung cancer.
Welcome to this session on the role of biomarker testing in non-small cell lung cancer. My name is Alex Drilon, and I'm the chief of the Early Drug Development Service and a thoracic medical oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. I'm joined today by Professor Kerr.
Thank you, Dr. Drilon. My name is Keith Kerr. I'm a consultant pathologist at Aberdeen Royal Infirmary and Aberdeen University Medical School in Scotland.
Thanks, Professor Kerr. In this session, we're going to be talking about the role of biomarker testing, as we mentioned, in non-small cell lung cancer, a very interesting field, and how that can support treatment decisions, which we'll do a deeper dive into in a later video. And perhaps, if you don't mind, Professor Kerr, I'll start off with really how dramatically the field has changed over the last two decades. And I'll start with the fact that there are many actionable oncogenes that have not only been identified, but are also currently matched to active targeted therapies that are approved in one or more healthcare environments. And initially, we knew in the late 90s about hotspot KRAS mutations, found out about sensitizing EGFR and ALK alterations. Now we have, in addition to the ALK fusions, RED, ROS1, NTRK1, 2, and 3. And to add to the EGFR mutations, we have HER2 mutations, we have BRAF V600E, we have MET exon 14. And beyond that, also, we're seeing that particular copy number changes, such as MET amplification, that's been shown to be actionable in clinical trials and is listed, for example, in things like the NCCN guidelines. So really, non-small cell lung cancer is, if you will, the archetype for harboring many actionable signatures. And I haven't even gotten to immunotherapy, which we'll touch on later. But Professor Kerr, given all of these advances, what are the current guidelines for testing so that we capture all of these actionable events?
Yeah, thank you. And you're absolutely right. The landscape has changed out of all recognition in the last 10 or 12 years with an enormous number of different biomarkers becoming relevant to make treatment decisions for our patients with particularly advanced non-small cell lung cancer. And as a result, we have many different guidelines trying to offer advice and steerage on how to approach this increasingly complex problem. And, you know, I think one of the things that's often pointed out is how different the guidelines are. But we have to remember that the pace of change that you alluded to is so dramatic, particularly in the last few years. It's actually impossible for most of the guidelines to keep up. Almost as soon as you publish a guideline, it's out of date. And many of the differences are a result of the time cycle of how often the guideline is reviewed. You know, NCCN produces a new guideline almost every other month, whereas some of the larger organizations, it's several years between guidelines involving a much deeper dive into the systemic literature.
And I think another point of confusion is this is good for patients, but in the diagnostic world also, there's a bit of a dichotomy between the you know, immunosensitizing biomarkers, PD-L1, TMB, and the oncogenic drivers. And hopefully these guidelines within different practice environments are moving towards being inclusive on both fronts. What's your thought on that?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think there are a number of issues that we'll probably touch on later around the mechanics and whose responsibility it is for delivering these different biomarkers. And then the assimilation of all the information leads us to sometimes some issues around a biomarker delivered on an immunohistochemistry test being available really quickly in 1 or 2 days, perhaps, whereas some of our broader next generation sequencing data can take 1, 2, or 3 weeks to come back. And, you know, the challenge is as more and more biomarkers are on the shopping list to be delivered is to figure out how we can appropriately deliver all of this information, sometimes in very challenging circumstances when it comes to the types of tissue material that we have to work with, and how to get all that information available for the treatment decision, because it doesn't all arrive at the same time, as you well know. It comes in drips and drabs, and you know, being patient, sometimes our patients can't wait very long. And, you know, we're aware of this in the laboratory as we try to develop our strategy for all this testing.
Those are really important points. And I think our listeners are keen to know how to actually execute, recognizing again that there are different ways of approaching biomarker testing. Certainly the prior paradigm was a little piecemeal, and now we're looking towards possibly consolidating into one big test, especially if you think like some of the more complex biomarkers, including say TMB, for which there's a tumor agnostic label for an immune checkpoint inhibitor, at least in the US. So what exactly do we do? What assays do we reach for? And is it important to do tumor testing alone? Or in some cases, do we lean on a liquid biopsy, plasma ctDNA?
Well, that's a complex question. So top line and very brief. Our first job is to deliver the biomarker tests that are required for immediate therapy decisions. And compared to the very long list that you described, in some health systems at least, the immediate priority may be quite a bit less. And in those circumstances, we perhaps can use single gene standalone tests. But the more and more genes that become priority up front, the more and more a multiplex platform like some form of NGS strategy becomes the practical alternative, provided it can be turned around quickly enough. And, you know, you alluded earlier to the fact that sometimes you have to hybridize because of the time issues. If you're thinking about enrolling patients into clinical trials or thinking about non-approved targets that may have drugs available off-label, then again, you're thinking about a slightly different strategy. So all of these things are important. And as a result, the dialogue between yourselves and the labs is crucially important in this regard. And remember that, you know, sometimes the samples that we have do not allow us to do all of the things that you would like us to do. So again, we need to strategize on the basis of what we think is deliverable. Sometimes we're pleasantly surprised and we get more. Sometimes we don't. And so it's a to and fro. It's an iterative process, I think, in order to reach our goal.
And just I threw a lot at you in the last question, but go back to the last thing that I think our listeners might be interested in. If we're thinking about deliverables and speed, where does a ctDNA assay position itself? Because potentially that result might come back quicker than an NGS on tissue.
You're right, and I apologize for not mentioning it. There's no question that the power, the possibilities from the so-called liquid biopsy are tremendous. And the speed question is one, although it's still subject to NGS and all of the issues within that particular analytical process. What, of course, it bypasses is the histological processing and examination that that comes before we do the tissue sequencing. I do believe that the two are complementary. I don't believe that it's one or the other. It's just that in some health systems, we haven't moved to a position where we can use these things complementary in a complementary fashion, you know, because of reimbursement issues and so on and so forth. And I do think as well, we're probably, at, you know, around the crest of that first wave of enthusiasm and hype, and we will cool off a little bit and we'll begin to learn how to use these different technologies in different ways. There's a lot more that can be said in this regard. There's no question it has fabulous potential. I think we're still learning on how to use it.
So to summarize, it looks like there has been a huge surge in the number of things we need to look for in someone's lung cancer. And as you mentioned, it's really a dialogue between pathologists and other providers as to the best way to meaningfully capture all of these. And at the end of the day, there are multiple tools, tumor and plasma, that we can utilize. So certainly we're in a much better place than before. Well, thank you to those watching this video today. You can find out more about MDT care for patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer in the other short videos in this activity.
Thank you for listening to this Touch podcast activity. You can access more content on this topic on Touch Oncology at www.touchoncology.com. Don't forget, there are also three other chapters in this series, so please listen in for further insights from the multidisciplinary team. Thank you.